Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe, and producer, Gus Cadavero. In the War Report, we report on recent developments in war and geopolitics around the world. By placing these developments in historical context, we show how they affect global stability and U.S. national security. This is not strictly an academic exercise. Our aim is to help Americans think critically about U.S. foreign policy so that we can develop the policy that best serves the interests of the nation and its people. Let's begin with the war in Ukraine. First, a little background. Although the Ukraine was once a republic within the Soviet Union, it became an independent country following the collapse of the Soviet Union at the end of the Cold War. Since the early 1990s, the United States and its allies have successfully pursued a strategy of incorporating former Soviet republics and Soviet allies into NATO, the Western Military Alliance. If the Ukraine is added to NATO, Russia would be virtually encircled. The current crisis in the Ukraine began in early 2014 when the elected pro-Russian government of Ukraine was overthrown in a U.S.-backed coup and placed with a pro-U.S. government amenable to joining NATO. Soon thereafter, the Russian ethnic minority in eastern Ukraine revolted, setting off a bloody civil war which so far has claimed thousands of lives, many of them civilians. In February of this year, the Russians brokered a ceasefire between the central Ukraine government in Kiev and the ethnic Russian separatists, but the ceasefire has proved tenuous. Marchand, what's the current situation on the ground in Ukraine?
Well, there's very little coverage coming out of the Western media at this stage, but what we're starting to hear, particularly through the independent press, and oddly enough through Twitter, is that the fighting has really intensified. There are videos coming out of shelling on both sides in the rebel-held areas of Donetsk, around the pro-Ukrainian city of Mariupol. There's intense shelling. There have been reports, actually, and this was reported through the Ukrainian government, that there were up to 400 rebel pro-Russian troops with tanks approaching the city of Mariupol and engaging Ukrainian forces in and around, in the suburbs in and around the city. What we're seeing is a elevation in the level of fighting. In addition to that, people have also witnessed a buildup of Russian troops inside the borders and outside. And again, a lot of this information coming through the independent media and through eyewitnesses on the ground, video of Russian tanks of soldiers in Russian uniform advancing into eastern Ukraine. So definitely the fighting has escalated significantly. I mean, the Minsk II peace accords, or ceasefire accords, I should say, are utterly meaningless. They keep saying it's falling apart. No, it has fallen apart. This is more than just the typical ceasefire violations. This is clearly a significant escalation.
Do we know which side sort of proverbially fired the first shot here to break the silence?
It's very difficult to tell at this stage because you have two very strong elements at this stage. Inside Ukraine, you have elements such as the right sector, or Pravi sector, as it's known in Ukrainian. Uh-huh. And they're the neo-Nazi militants, and I call them neo-Nazi militants because they use Nazi symbols. I mean,
because
it's not
are.
Exactly. The fact is that they had an interest. They said they did not recognize the Minsk II Accords. They did not recognize the ceasefire, and they wanted to resume the war. And they've been at loggerheads with the current Ukrainian government. So there's that element. On the other hand, you also have the Russians. The ceasefire was working for them in so much as it solidified the battle line, as it were. It forced back the Ukrainian army. But in the same vein, they saw a buildup of NATO forces inside Ukraine. American military advisors from the 173rd Airborne. There were British military advisors there. There have been other NATO military advisors. There have been Ukrainian troops training in Poland. There have been Ukrainian troops training throughout NATO. So from the Russian perspective, they realize that this ceasefire is only a respite. Now, whether they know the Ukrainian government eventually wants to retake the East, whether that's practical or not, who knows, but the ceasefire is allowing for a further NATO buildup. So it's one of those things where Russia's looking at its history, and they remember when they divided Poland with the Germans, and they ignored the German military buildup, and that resulted in the invasion of Russia. I'm not arguing that NATO is Nazi Germany and going to invade Russia. I'm not arguing that. But what I'm arguing is that from the Russian perspective, because you have to get into their mindset, you have to see this from the Russian point of view, from their perspective, it is a NATO buildup. It is a foreign armies buildup right at their doorstep. So they might have an interest in seeing a resumption of the war to drive NATO out of Ukraine.
And of course, this isn't happening in possibilities. This isn't happening in a historical vacuum. Since the end of the Cold War, NATO has doubled in size to 28 members, and it really wants badly to bring Ukraine into NATO. This is right on Russia's doorstep, and NATO is establishing 6 rapid deployment force units to be stationed in Eastern Europe, in Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, and Romania to meet the Russian supposed Russian threat to deter Russian aggression in Europe. So the Russians have to feel pretty threatened.
Russia is not a country you try to hem in. One of the strengths we saw, oddly enough, of the Bush administration, the Bush Jr. administration, was that they recognized Russia's spheres of influence. As a result, Russia recognized ours. When you had the Orange Revolution, a pro-Western revolution, the Russians influenced the new Ukrainian government, shall we say, by poisoning, it is believed, the Ukrainian president. So it immediately brought Ukraine back into Russia's sphere of influence. We didn't try to intervene. And part of the reason was there was a tacit understanding that NATO is our sphere. You have Ukraine. You have parts of Georgia. You have your sphere of influence. You have yours. We have ours. And that was actually at that time we also saw a significant withdrawal of Russian forces from Cuba.
As we've talked about before, when the Cold War ended, really due to the humongous spending under Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, Cold War ended around 1990 with Mikhail Gorbachev basically throwing in the towel, making the Soviet Union a voluntary association, withdrawing his troops from Eastern Europe. It was a really golden opportunity for world peace. And the first thing that we did with the Reagan successor, Bush Sr., was invade the Persian Gulf and begin this drive towards American global hegemony, which took us to the breakup of Yugoslavia, to the invasion of Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, now the overthrow of the Syrian government. It seems to me a missed opportunity that we had in 1990 to have peace, and we seem to be going step by step closer to a war with Russia. Is this going to slowly go up and up until it's a full-blown conventional war in the Ukraine?
I think it runs a very significant risk. Let's not forget that World War I started because of conflict in the Balkans. And Russia's in a position where it can't afford to back down. Putin can't afford to back down because one of the things that's keeping him and his party in power right now is the fact that he's standing up to the West. And the Russians could feasibly, they have a large enough army, they could overrun most of Europe, or at least most of Eastern Europe, I should say, you know, the Baltic states, Ukraine, Poland, really before we had a chance to mobilize. So they have a very strong hand.
Are we really up to a conventional war in Eastern Europe?
Not at this stage. We are leaning very heavily on our NATO allies. Militarily speaking, we've dismantled almost all of our armored divisions. To the best of my knowledge, there's only really one armored division that we actually have still combat ready. Most of them have been demobilized. Our army is smaller than it was before World War II. Right as we speak, the army's cutting another 40,000 troops. We may see very soon a point at which our active component is less than 400,000 soldiers. Our military right now is not in a position to have a major ground conflict. So I think at this stage, we're relying very heavily on our NATO allies. And that having been said, our NATO allies aren't necessarily the most eager ones right now for war with Russia. You do have the Poles and the Baltic states that are fanatically anti-Russian. But at the same time, you have an element in Germany which says, hey, listen, you Americans might be eager for war, but we remember the last time the Russians were in Berlin. Then you have elements like the French. The French are not eager for a conflict with Russia. The British, more so on the fence. They're more in our camp. But still, if we're relying on the fanaticism of the Poles and the Romanians and the Estonians, Latvians, and Lithuanians, they might have fighting spirit, but their armies are very,
yeah,
very
that's
small.
I see your point, Marshawn, because why would the Germans risk the horrors of another world war, the destruction of Germany at the hands of the Russians, over the Ukraine? Is it that important to them?
For us, World War I and World War II were distant. They were over there. You know, how many interviews can you find with American World War I veterans and documentaries? It's very, very difficult to find it. On the other hand, it's very common to find documentaries and interviews with British and French and German World War I vets, World War II vets. I mean, we have our World War II vets documentaries, but especially World War I, really one of the most horrific wars on European soil. they recorded that history more so than any other aspect of their military history, because they remember the horrors of trench warfare. And then when it came to World War II, where we put the emphasis on the Normandy landings, taking Iwo Jima and whatnot, their emphasis tends to be on the devastation of their cities, London during the Blitz, you know, things like that. So for them, a European war is not something glamorous over there. Mm-hmm. It may result in bombs falling on London. It may result in bombs falling on Paris. It may result in bombs falling on Berlin. So that to them is a very scary reality. Now for the Poles and the Lithuanians and the Estonians and the Latvians, for them it's the fear of their loss of independence. We're going very cavalier into a war that A, our allies are really not certain whether they want to experience it again, and B, we ourselves are not militarily in a position to challenge them. We might have the, for the sake of argument, the B-2 stealth bomber, great piece of machinery, but if the Russians have hundreds of bombers which are just slightly inferior, or hundreds of fighters that are slightly inferior to ours, well, it's a numbers game. 20 million Russians died in World War II. They didn't give up. They didn't give it. They kept fighting until they took Berlin. The Germans, who had far better technology, far better training, lost because they were bled down by the just sheer force of will of the Russian people.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator and producer, Gus Cantavero. We've been updating you on the situation in the Ukraine, and now, Marshawn and Gus, I'd like to move on to the Mideast, and in particular, the latest developments in Syria. Just a little background on the Syrian situation. Former NATO commander, U.S. General Wesley Clark, reported a few years ago that Syria was included in a post-9/11 Pentagon list of 7 Mideast countries targeted for overthrow by the United States, others including Iraq, Libya, and Iran. Under the Bush administration, the U.S. government funded so-called pro-democracy operations aimed at bringing a new government to Syria. In 2010, Robert Ford, the new U.S. ambassador to Syria, began meeting with Syrian opposition groups, and anti-government violence broke out soon thereafter. Later in 2010, Adebka, the Israeli intelligence newsletter that we often cite in this show, reported that U.S. allies Qatar and Saudi Arabia were bringing jihadist fighters from Libya into the Turkish-Syrian border to conduct anti-government fighting. Now, these fighters had been used by the United States in its overthrow of the pro-Russian Libyan government that same year. While the U.S. also funded and trained a non-jihadist force called the Syrian Free Army to overthrow the Syrian government, recent disclosures show that the U.S. government, the Defense Intelligence Agency in particular, has known since at least 2012 that most of the anti-government fighting in Syria has been carried on by jihadists who eventually morphed into ISIS. But the situation in Syria is not limited to a three-way fight between the Syrian government, the so-called moderate rebels, and ISIS. The Turks and the Kurds recently entered the fray, ostensibly to fight ISIS, while the Russians and the Iranians, allies of Syria, are now in Syria to help protect the government. So now I count 8 players in the Syrian war: the beleaguered Syrian government, its allies, Russia and Iran on one side, and the United States, ISIS, the so-called moderate rebels, the Turks and the Kurds on the other side. And these alliances are not exactly very neat. Marshawn, can you please help us make some sense of this situation?
The most important elements in Syria at this stage are the al-Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda in Syria, the Syrian government with its Iranian allies and Russian advisors, and then, of course, ISIS are the three most. Now, you have the Kurds.
Marshawn, just to make clear, the al-Nusra Front is nominally allied with the United States in attempting to overthrow the Syrian government, correct?
Yes and no. We consider them a terrorist organization. We are not directly supporting them, but we are ipso facto on the same side because we're both fighting ISIS. The thing that's very complicated is Al-Qaeda and ISIS are not in the same camp. Al-Qaeda has had its own agenda. Al-Qaeda was the number one terrorist organization for the last really 20 years. But they become eclipsed by ISIS. Many of their supporters have defected and joined ISIS. In fact, I read a very interesting article that said that Al-Qaeda is finding itself in a position where it can't even afford rent. Al-Qaeda has become very anti-ISIS. In fact, the leader of Al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, has sworn allegiance to the head of the Taliban. And it's interesting because the Taliban's anti-ISIS as well.
Well, we started this attempt to overthrow the Syrian government. Jihadists were on our side as useful for getting rid of Assad. But now there's kind of a split where the ISIS jihadists are now our enemy, although they share our desire to get rid of Assad. And the Al-Qaeda jihadists are still with us, sort of.
From Go, there never was a united Syrian front. There were collections of secularists on the one hand and the Free Syrian Army, quote-unquote, jihadists, and all these organizations fought with each other as much as they fought Assad. It wasn't until ISIS came onto the field that all these organizations that we had given money and guns to, because fundamentally we didn't care who we funded as long as they were anti-Assad,
right,
all these organizations that we gave money and guns to defected, and with the money and guns we gave them, defected and joined ISIS. The only entities in Syria which had been fighting the Assad government, which didn't defect, were the al-Nusra Front and the Kurds. And the Kurds have always kind of walked a fine line between they don't really like Assad, but they don't like ISIS more. And now they're fighting the Turks as well.
So now, if you could spend a little bit on the Turks. So the Turks and the Kurds, because the Turks had been kind of holding back, although they were allowing us to use border territory to insert so-called rebels into Syria to overthrow Assad. Now Turkey's assumed a more active role, supposedly fighting ISIS. Turkey's allowed the U.S. to bring planes and troops to Turkey.
And they had held back the Kurds purposefully.
But now the Kurds are also fighting in Syria, and they are coordinating with the U.S. with respect to airstrikes on ISIS. So the situation is gotten more complex because they have really strong issues between them, right? Can you talk about the Turks and the Kurds?
Well, the Kurds, mainly the ones in Syria, are affiliated with the PKK. On the one hand, both the PKK and the Kurdish government have been duking it out with ISIS, and we've been supporting them in this slogging match with ISIS. Well, the Turks come in, and they realize that the Kurds might end up getting a huge chunk of land and really deciding we want a piece of Turkey now, especially for the PKK, because they've wanted a piece of Turkey for a very long time. So the Turks decide to jump in, and instead of bombing ISIS, they start bombing the Kurds, who are our friends. But we don't want to stand up to the Turks because the Turks, next to the United States, have the largest military in NATO. We've agreed to look the other way. Well, on the one hand, we arm the Kurds. On the other hand, our allies bomb the Kurds. And then we got Al-Qaeda, who's on our side fighting the Kurds as well, and ISIS and the Syrian government. And then we got the Syrian government who's fighting ISIS, but we don't like the Syrian government.
My God.
It is, I mean,
it's like a soap opera.
It is. What's the priority now, Marshawn? Is it to fight ISIS, which includes jihadists that we once encouraged to overthrow Assad? Or is it for us to overthrow Assad?
Everything's the priority.
What's the priority?
All at once, everything. If a general actually wrote this down on paper and then presented it to the president or something, or went on Meet the Press and said, yes, there are 17 sides. They all hate us. We hate all of them. But I think it might benefit us if we get involved in this.
We want the best of all worlds. We want Assad gone. We want ISIS beaten. We want a strong Iraqi government, but not too strong. We want to empower the regional allies, but we don't want the regional allies taking power. Mm-hmm. The whole time we are in this sort of limbo, if you will, because the regional players are not capable of dealing with it themselves, in large part also because we don't really want to arm them. You know, the Egyptian government had several years ago asked for Apache helicopters to fight terrorists in the Sinai, and we said no. Now these terrorists went on to become ISIS in Sinai, and now they're battering the Egyptian army. Silly.
And of course, Marshawn and Gus, as we talked about, the Russians and the Iranians are in the mix because they're trying to keep their ally, the Syrian government, intact. And Debka reported recently that six Russian MiG-31 Foxhound interceptors from Moscow landed just a few days ago in Syria, near Damascus International Airport, and they were followed by a large transports which delivered 1,000 third-generation anti-tank guided missiles. So what does this mean for the situation? The Russians going to be more forcefully engaged in defending the Syrian government?
For them, the loss of Syria, the fall of Assad, means the loss of the port of Tarsus on the Syrian coast, which is their only base in the Mediterranean, although they're working out a deal to have a naval base in Alexandria as well. But still, the loss of Syria would be a huge blow for Russian influence in the Middle East. They can't allow the Assad government to fall. So we are seeing deeper Russian involvement. But also the Russians build a sense of trust because the allies that you arm, presumably also, you can cut off that funding. So you kind of join them at the hip. because what we're also seeing is that Russia has agreed to sell the Iranian government S-300 surface-to-air missile systems. And several American military experts have actually said, some speaking on condition of anonymity, have said that these can bring down the vast majority of U.S. aircraft. We don't know fully what it's capable of because it's never gone up against U.S. aircraft, but it would make our air power, as well as that of our Israeli allies, pretty much a moot point.
Now, you mentioned Egypt. The war is really expanding beyond Syria and Iraq because recently ISIS in Egypt destroyed an Egyptian naval vessel and also conducted significant ambushes in the Sinai, which I believe it now virtually controls. Could you talk about ISIS and influence in Egypt?
Well, the group in the Sinai was called Ansar Beit al-Maqdis, which means Victors of Jerusalem, is one translation. They were a militant group, not necessarily, I don't know, they might have been affiliated with Al-Qaeda, might not. The big thing was that once they had decided we are going to give what's called bay'ah in Arabic, give bay'ah to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, that meant subservience. Allegiance in the Arab world has a different concept than allegiance in the United States. You know, we look at groups that declare allegiance to each other, terrorist groups or criminal organizations. To us, it means they become allies. Well, the concept of bay'ah in Arabic means specifically you to become subservient. When you give bay'ah to somebody, you're not acknowledging equals. You're giving a religious oath to be subservient, to make your armies and your supporters and everybody who supports you now must support whoever you've given the bay'ah to, whoever you've given the allegiance to. So by giving the allegiance to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, to ISIS, to that organization, they've made themselves a part of the organization. But there is a give and take. Because they gave the bay'ah, they now, their army has become the ISIS army, which means ISIS now is funding them and is arming them, and moreover, is training them. The ISIS generals now lead the armies in the Sinai, because as part of when you give the bay'ah, when you make yourself subservient, you now acknowledge that you're going to be under the command of that person's generals. Where you had basically a handful of poorly led militants before who perpetrate bombings here and there, now you have very well-trained militants coming over from Iraq and Syria who've been commanding armies in the name of ISIS, going to the Sinai at the behest of the ISIS leadership to lead these forces in the Sinai. And that's why we've seen the combat effectiveness of these militants in what they call the Sinai province skyrocketing.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN, 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host. I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and producer Gus Cantavero. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month from noon to 1 p.m. To download a copy of this show and sign up for podcasts, visit our website, incontextreport.com. Shows are also available through iTunes and are archived at WPKN.org and Radio for All. You can watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. Now, Marshawn and Gus, as we talk about the situation in Syria and in Ukraine as well, one wonders whether American expansionism has created a lot more trouble for this nation and it's worth it, and whether we should be fundamentally rethinking this policy of expansion and focusing more on protecting the United States frontier, its own boundaries, and on reviving our economy. And I'm wondering if the recent deal that the Obama administration has negotiated over the nuclear power with Iran is an indication, perhaps, that the United States is going to start to rethink this policy of expansion. What do you gentlemen think about this proposed agreement with Iran? Is it in the U.S. national interest?
I do think so. I support the agreement, and I'm definitely no fan of Obama. I do think that it benefits the nation as a whole because it does put us on a better negotiating stance with the rest of the world. There is no international intelligence agency that supports the view that Iran is close to or currently pursuing a nuclear weapon. And that is completely in spite of what Benjamin Netanyahu got in front of Congress with his silly bomb poster and said. It's completely in the face of what Lindsey Graham or Ted Cruz or any of these other war chicken hawks, really, because none of them would dare to pick up a gun and fight themselves. They just want to send other people's kids to go die. taking us off of the war footing, at least on this one stance, is a step forward for the country, because it opens up free trade to this country so that we can improve our relationship with them on an economic stance, rather than always being, you know, with our fists in the air and negotiating from a point of opposition rather than a friendship.
Marshawn, what do you believe?
Well, I think just looking at it from a military standpoint, I mean, I have to agree with Gus, is at the end of the day, we do not have the military capability to face off against Iran. The presidential candidate, Marco Rubio, said, oh, well, we'll just bomb them. We'll just bomb them. Yeah, you and what army? And when I say what army, I mean literally what army. We are not facing the Saddam army of 2003. Well, first of all, when we faced Saddam down in 2003, our army was much larger, much better funded, much better equipped. And we were ready to devastate an army that had already been beaten and battered pretty bloody, because you have to remember, before they fought us in 1991, they fought a bloody war against the Iranians, and then they just finished it, and then they got battered bloody by us in the first Gulf War, then a decade of sanctions, then we invade. They were in they didn't stand a chance. On the other hand, you look at the Iranians. First of all, the Iranians, especially from their Quds force, their elite Revolutionary Guard, have a lot of combat experience fighting in Iraq, fighting in Syria, fighting in Lebanon. We are facing leadership with combat experience, but additionally, and probably most importantly, they've been armed to the teeth by the Russians, some of the latest in military hardware. I mean, again, this S-300 missile system, Saddam had nothing close. In 2003, Saddam was shooting us with flak cannons. If the Iranians have S-300 missile systems, that means they can knock our planes down. Maybe not all of them, but they can knock some of them down. They can negate much of our air power, maybe not eliminate it, but they can make us getting air superiority much harder. Again, also, Iran is a much tougher country to fight in. It is a lot more mountainous in places. They have a much larger army and a much better trained army than Saddam had, considering most of their army's been trained by the Russians. If we were to go up against the Iranians tomorrow, we would need an army able to go into the country, at least 150,000 troops to go into the country.
Marshawn,
we just don't have that at this point.
Given your assessment of the military situation, it sounds like we've got a pretty good deal with the Iranians. They promised not to enrich uranium anywhere near to what it would require to be used for
and
a
their
nuclear
waste
bomb.
Has to be sent out of the country.
Their waste has to be sent out of the country, so it can't be made available for bomb use. They're going to drastically reduce their current inventory of low-enriched uranium.
The centrifuge number is going to drop significantly.
Their new nuclear power plant is going to be reconfigured, so it will not produce bomb-grade plutonium. Mm-hmm. Of course, they're going to be open to inspection by foreigners. So It seems to me that, given what you said about their military strength, they've made some pretty significant concessions, and that we got a reasonably a good deal out of it.
Whether we like it or not is, at this stage, the only choice we have, because we don't have the capability of going
after. And of course, in this show, we, Marshawn and Gus, we do like to look at history so people understand the context. And our relationship with Iran went bad in 1953 when the United States CIA overthrew the democratically elected government of Mossadegh in Iran in a coup was called Operation Ajax. It was run by Teddy Roosevelt's grandson, Kermit Roosevelt. It was the means by which we put in place the Shah, who ran the country for a quarter century as a terrible despot. He had his brutal secret police that we helped set up. And that's really what soured our relationship with Iran. And I would say that that was a huge mistake, because Iran is logically, when you look at a map, should be an ally of the United States. It is a natural buffer to the expansion of the Russians to the south. In addition to that, culturally,
they're fans of Western culture.
They're totally receptive to Western culture. It's a religious country, so they relate better to us than, for example, China, which is a militantly a secular communist nation. We should not only be allies with Iran, but we should desire an Iran that would have a significant amount of power in the region for the stabilizing effect it would have in what's a really now becoming more and more a chaotic, balkanized situation.
I would like to just say a word on, you know, with the Republican candidates being very verbose now to try to outdo each other and become more of a war hawk than the next one so that they can stand out, because I guess that's the impression they get from the electorate, that we just love a verbose, blustering war hawk. They have been echoing the same reaction, which is to say that this is a bad deal and that if Marco Rubio becomes president, he will renege on the deal because we gave away too much or whatever. That's basically what they're all saying. We gave away too much. Have you ever negotiated with somebody coming from such a distant stance like we were and said, you have to give up everything before I give you anything. Have you ever had a successful negotiation like that? Personally, have you?
Of course not. If we really want to make sure that Iran didn't get the bomb, the Russians are the ones who have the ultimate influence, because right now what keeps Iran's economy afloat is Russia. What keeps Iran's army strong is Russia. What keeps its army trained and its jets with parts and its surface.
And that's because of these terrible sanctions that cripple them. And now, this could be a positive or a negative, but the arms industry can now sell to Iran. So that means that we can actually compete for business, and that Russia won't be the only supplier, right? So if we can actually have economic relationships with this country, both on the individual citizenry and with the government, why would it not seem obvious to you that this would benefit our countries?
And you know, Gus, the point of view that you and March are expressing is echoed by a large number of retired generals and admirals who've written that they support the deal. Mm-hmm. And it's also interesting to note in terms of American politics that some polls show that a majority of American Jews support the deal with Iran, despite the fact that some prominent senators like Charles Schumer of New York have come out against it. I think the Jewish community in the United States is sensible enough to see that in the long term, this is going to lead to more stability.
The Jewish lobby is pretty much united against it.
That's
but
right.
They're a mouthpiece of the government.
Of the Israeli government, but the rank and file in the United States.
There's some dissent, for sure.
Yeah, are not going along with
it. I think they're definitely tired of war, don't you think?
Yeah, I think they want to see stability. It's going to be interesting to see if this is stopped by the Republicans. So far, it looks like most of the Democrats are sticking with it. I saw just recently that Connecticut Congressman Democrat Jim Himes has announced, after some discussion and deliberation, he met with the Israeli ambassador, that he is supporting the treaty. And I think that's an indication that the Democratic Party in general is going to stay with President Obama on this. If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and producer Gus Cantavero. And we've been talking most recently about the proposed treaty with Iran, having to do with the development of nuclear weapons. And I'd like to move on now to Asia, because we just passed a very important anniversary, the 70th anniversary of Japan's surrender. It occurred on August 15th, 1945, that ended the war in the Pacific. This followed the United States dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima on August 6th and Nagasaki on August the 9th. It was much awaited to see what Prime Minister Abe of Japan would say on the anniversary of the end of the war. What do you make of his statement at this anniversary, Marchand?
As with many, many Japanese statements, it's very cryptic. The Japanese, they do not speak directly very often. Their language can be either direct or incredibly ambiguous, depending on how they want to use it. Mm-hmm. He expressed remorse, but never apologized for World War II. Part of that can be chalked up to the fact that you can't expect people to apologize forever for having done what they did in a war, however horrible. I mean, the Japanese excesses during World War II were heinous beyond all belief. But if you keep trying to shame them for decades and decades, I mean, 70 years later, eventually there's going to start to be a backlash. But there's a backlash in the traditional Japanese fashion. It's interesting to note that the most militantly nationalist party in Japan is called the Liberal Democratic Party. Not like you'd expect in other countries, like in Russia, United Russia. No, in Japan, it's the Liberal Democratic Party, but that's the most militantly nationalist party. So Abe played the remorse, but by omitting an apology, was a statement of Japanese nationalism.
And didn't he indicate that this would be the last time they would apologize? He said future generations shouldn't be saddled with this.
Well, and that's actually the most important statement that he made, because by saying that future generations should not have to apologize for the past was a way of also signaling to the Japanese people, more than anything else, it is time for us to stop being sorry for what happened and start being Japanese again, because every generation following World War II had been saddled with this immense guilt. But I think one of the things that's really shaping the Japanese mindset today is what's been going on with China, what's been going on with North Korea, and what they see happening with Russia, and what they also see happening in the Middle East. One of the things the Japanese are realizing is that the U.S. has become a fair-weather ally. And it's really sad to say, because it used to be that countries looked to us as their protector, because rain or shine, we were there for them, you know? We were the winter soldiers. now what they see from what especially happened in Iraq, well, we abandoned our allies. ISIS began to emerge, and we told the Iraqi army, you're on your own. From the Japanese perspective, they see what's going on. The North Koreans sink a South Korean vessel, kill 43 South Korean sailors. We tell the South Koreans, hey, don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. Imagine if those were American sailors. It'll blow over. Imagine if those were American sailors, right? How outraged we'd be.
Yeah.
But we tell the South Koreans, don't worry about it. So the Japanese have been watching all this happen for a very long time, and they're thinking to themselves, well, if the Chinese invade, will the Americans come to our aid? Mm-hmm. If the Russians invade, because they are in disputes over the northern islands of Japan, the Sakhalin Islands, with the Russians, they're in a dispute with the Russians. If the Russians invade, who's going to protect us? If the Chinese invade, who's going to protect us? If the North Koreans shoot a nuke at us, who's going to protect us? Because for us, the North Koreans have a nuke. It's all the way over there.
Martin, you mentioned the Sakhalin Islands. And of course, the Japanese suffered greatly at Hiroshima, Nagasaki. We're talking a couple 100,000 people at least, either were killed instantly or soon thereafter from the radiation. And in addition, the United States killed an estimated 500,000 people in conventional bombing of Japanese cities towards the end of World War II. Obviously, the Japanese have a lot of reason to have hostility towards the United States, but at the same time, people may not be aware that Russia was moving in on Japan towards the end of the war, which a lot of historians now think was had to do with the dropping of the bombs. Could you talk about the Russians' aggression towards Japan towards the end of World War II?
The Russians came into the war in mid-1945 after the Germans surrender on May 8th. The Russians immediately started shifting to the east. Now, part of this was based on an agreement that had been made originally with Roosevelt, who by this time was dead, but an agreement between Roosevelt and Stalin, where Roosevelt had basically said, once Germany's defeated, you can enter the war in the east and take pretty much of China and Japan as you see fit. Roosevelt had an understanding with Stalin that Stalin would be able to have, at least from some of the sources I've read, the northern half of Japan. Now, Truman became president. Truman was not as soft on Stalin as trusting in Stalin, I should say, as Roosevelt was. Truman realized that once the Russians had entered the war, the Japanese army was a guerrilla army, fundamentally. They were experts in suppressing insurgencies. They were great at fighting an army like the Chinese, who were fighting with World War I era weapons. But when it came up against a modern army like the Russians, the Japanese didn't stand a chance, especially in open terrain. When the Russians invaded Manchuria, they also seized a series of islands north of Japan. Their eventual goal was to invade the Japanese mainland. One of the big reasons, it appears, for the dropping of the bomb was because we knew if the Japanese didn't surrender soon enough, the Russians might seize most or all of Japan. Number one, we had to demonstrate, we had to get to Japan before the Russians did, which meant either dropping the bomb or a ground invasion, which would cost 500,000 lives, or alternatively, run the risk of losing the Pacific. The other reason for the bomb dropping, too, was it was meant to scare the Russians, because the Russians didn't have the bomb. By dropping it and demonstrating that we not only had one, but we had multiples, and this was the devastation it would cause, there was something much broader, much bigger at stake in terms of our foreign policy than the Japanese.
In fact, General MacArthur presented peace proposals from Japan to Franklin Roosevelt at Yalta in January of 1945. That were similar to those which the United States ultimately obtained, because the Japanese by 45, I think that really after Midway, they knew they couldn't win the war. But by 45, they were looking for a way to end the war, and they just wanted to save some face,
right,
really, by keeping the emperor, which, of course, we ended up saying, yeah, keep the emperor, because we thought he'd be useful for post-war stability.
Well, if anyone's ever negotiated with Japanese before or read anything about Japanese business, you understand that the negotiation process takes a while, that they have to consult up and down the chain a million times. They have to do it as a group. They have to reach a consensus. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately they come and they either accept or reject the proposal. But the one thing everybody in business knows with Japanese is that you're going to scare them away from the table if you come heavy-handed.
Yes.
And that was exactly what they did, was they came and they said, okay, you either accept or you decline the proposal. You decline, okay,
unconditional here, surrender. That's
have
it.
Some bombs.
That's it.
We'll kill a million of your civilians.
Well, now the Japanese are not only afraid of the Russians, but they're also pretty scared of the Chinese. And the Russians and the Chinese are cooperating militarily, partly, I think, because we're so hostile to the Russians. They're in the arms of the Chinese right now. Can you talk about the Russian and the Chinese naval exercises in the Pacific?
According to the Washington Post and according to Russia Today and the International Business Times and several various other news outlets, a naval exercise between the Russians and the Chinese will be taking place between August 20th and the 28th. This exercise is going to be in the Sea of Japan, nominally run out of the Russian naval base at Vladivostok, which is in the Sea of Japan. And it's going to be practicing joint beach landings, naval landings of Marines and their personnel to seize beachheads, which obviously in the Pacific, it's islands. You know, island hopping is a given, I'm sure. From the Japanese perspective, especially because it's happening right across the pond from them. I mean, it would be literally within commuting distance, you know, if it was on land, as it were. If we were to, let's say, see a joint naval exercise between the Mexican Navy and the Russian Navy in the Gulf of Mexico, and they're practicing beach landings, who would we think that's targeted at? It's natural the Japanese will feel that this exercise is directly targeted at them, and if not them, it's directly targeted at encircling them by attacking their potential regional allies. This is a direct challenge to U.S. influence in the Pacific, and one of the reasons why we're seeing this remilitarization of Japan is this is also not the first joint naval exercise the Russians and the Chinese have conducted. They've conducted several over the last, really, 10 years. They've conducted a lot of joint naval exercises. And so this is emphasized in the minds of the Japanese that this is a clear and present danger. This is an immediate danger. And that's one of the reasons for the resurgence of Japanese nationalism, the rearming of their military. The bill that's being passed right now through the Diet, which is the Japanese parliament, to allow Japanese forces to deploy in combat overseas to support their allies.
If a war were to break out in the Pacific, would China only attack if it had the cooperation of Russia? And if there was a war, would it simultaneously target South Korea as well as Japan?
That would be my guess. Again, this is why it would become invariably a global conflict. This is what happened in World War I. This is what happened in World War II. Everybody decides they want their slice of the pie. Most likely what you would have to have is Russian and Chinese cooperation, because also the Russians, they're allies of the Chinese, but they don't entirely trust them. They wouldn't want the Chinese to go it alone in the Pacific and end up losing control, because Russia views itself as a Pacific power as well. They would almost have to cooperate with each other. An attack on South Korea would probably be inevitable, because all the Chinese would have to do is let the North Koreans off their leash. The South Korean army is very small, and we have about 24,000 troops in South Korea, but if there's a wider war in the Pacific and possibly a wider war in Europe, there's no way we'd be able to mobilize enough troops into Korea in time to stop the North Koreans. And it would leave the Chinese free to attack the Philippines, to attack Japan. Again, this is all a hypothetical. I'm just spitballing here, as it were.
Yeah, these are dominoes that would logically fall. And it's really just kind of as far as the instigator wants to take it. You know, we got to remember that these places are on the other side of the planet.
Yes, and after all, the Japanese, they looked at the map in the 1930s and they said, why are the British, why are the Dutch controlling Asia?
Right, you know, right.
They don't have any business being here. And I imagine the Chinese are thinking the same thing. Why are the Americans and their surrogates controlling the Pacific? Mm-hmm. Why not us?
But not only just that, if we were to actually fight, how much fuel would we have to spend, the supply chain, to get that many men over there? We did it during World War II, but it took the entire engine of the United States to make it happen.
And is this in the interest of the United States?
Right.
Is it the interest
in
the American people? What did the American people, what would we get out of this? I think Russia is an easier case than
I'll
China.
Say this. I bet it wouldn't even stem the flow of Nikes.
Well, that's right. Business comes first. But cooperation with the Russians, to me, is a fairly easy thing to imagine. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think we've unnecessarily provoked the Russians. We blew this opportunity mm-hmm. that Gorbachev offered us in 1990. I think that the Russians want to be part of Europe.
Sure.
But on the other hand,
what's the old insult that happened that prevents us from ever coming to the table with them? Like, what happened? Did someone insult someone 40 years ago and we're not over it?
I think it was the expansionist policies of George Bush Sr. and his crowd. When the Russians surrendered in the Cold War, mm-hmm. they just could not resist the temptation to assert global hegemony. Now, if we had a good cooperation with Russia, I would think it would help tremendously
sure.
in our relationship with China.
Well, it's illogical to not pursue that.
If you look at the policies during Bush Jr. administration, when our relations were the warmest with the Russians, you saw the Chinese and the North Koreans and all those players take more of a bit of a step back. Because we had the Chinese at that point hemmed in on all sides. Russia was in our camp. Russia was our friend. Now, granted, Russia overthrew a few governments. We overthrew a few governments. But there was wider stability. Well, we blew it in the 1990s. But we started to get it back under Bush Jr. And then when President Obama became president, I don't know what it was, but he decided he wanted his pound of flesh from the Russians.
Yeah, they have not had a good negotiating
stance. No, well,
stance.
That was, remember, yeah. Secretary of State Clinton had that reset, which was completely failed. Remember the Russian reset?
No, I actually don't remember that.
That was one of her big initiatives, which she's going to improve relationships with Russia, and it was a disaster. Things just got worse. But I think we're going to have to leave that particular subject there. I want to remind listeners that this is the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. This is your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe, and I'm with Marshawn McDermott-Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and our producer, Gus Candavero. And as we come to the close of the show, I just wanted to return to the United States and take a look at the presidential election and its implications for foreign policy. Now, Gus, what did you think of the recent Republican debate? Did it shed any light on the candidates' views on foreign policy?
No, in fact, it didn't. Because what it did shed light on is that they know next to nothing about anything that happens in the world. They do seem to have a little bit more specifics when it comes to domestic policy, like doing what to do about the different scandals that have happened, the IRS tax codes, things like that. They'll come with some details like that. Okay. Some of them are good ideas and some aren't. When it comes to foreign policy, they not only have really stupid solutions for the problems that are happening in the world, but they literally confuse the sides of the conflict. And ISIS was a big topic of conversation during the last debate. You actually had people saying that ISIS and Iran were on the same side, that this nuclear deal was somehow related to ISIS gaining ground into Iraq. And of course, these things, not only are they separate issues, they're nothing to do with each other.
Actually, they're completely wrong because the Iranians are committed to keeping Assad in power and ISIS wants to overthrow Assad.
Not only that, but they're completely different sects of Islam. You know, you have Iran, which is a Shia, and then you have ISIS, which is Sunni, and they literally hate each other.
It is really amazing how little they know about foreign policy.
Well, it's shocking because if you want to be a commander-in-chief and you want to bring a proposal forward to say, this is how we ought to fix the situation, you ought to understand the different sides and the different factions.
And also the history. I doubt if any of them has a clue as to how this conflict began.
No.
With the importation of jihadist fighters from Libya into the Turkish-Syrian border, and that it was the policy of the United States to overthrow the Syrian government that's really led to this carnage in Syria.
Well, which is why I think that Jeb Bush is really just a disaster in the making or in the waiting, because we've already talked before about what a disastrous foreign policy Bush Sr. had, followed by George Bush Jr., and what we all know what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. And now Jeb Bush says we can defeat ISIS just with air power. But then when confronted with details, he's very, very vague on how that would actually
and
happen.
And Senator Lindsey Graham has taken issue. He says we need American ground troops in order to defeat ISIS.
Right. And if he said that he would actually put a helmet on and go to the front lines, I think I may actually think he has some guts. But like I said before, he's a chicken hawk. Yeah. He's the kind of guy that sends other people's kids to die.
And let's examine, why are we there to begin with? Is it our
what are we accomplishing?
It's not in our interest to overthrow Assad to begin with, because he was a stabilizing influence. He was not, he's not supporting
not
terror.
A good guy,
not
but
a good, but he's an autocrat, but he wasn't supporting terrorism,
right.
Terrorism, and he was tolerant of Christians, mm-hmm. and other religious minorities in Syria, so he's
right.
Hardly the top of the
I keep hearing
list.
People, you know, social media is a good place to go for this kind of insanity. You know, they keep on posting things about the Christians being beheaded by ISIS and so forth. But no one asks the logical question, oh, how are there Christians there to be beheaded in the beginning? If all Islam and all the different presidents and, you know, Assad and all these dictators were equally as bad and they all should be overthrown, how is it that there are Christians and Jews living in harmony next
Putin
to each other?
Putin is an autocrat, but there's religious toleration in
right,
Russia.
Right, right. I understand that people are upset that minority groups are being killed, but somebody paint me a picture of what success looks like. You can't have a mission without an end game, without what the end is going to look like, what we're striving for, because right now we're pushing in all these different directions and you're literally undoing the good that you're doing on one front line by countering it
with what
you're doing on the other.
Instead of asking, should we have a bombing campaign or should we have troops on the ground, we should be asking, what's wrong with this foreign policy?
Mm-hmm.
Should we be involved in Syria at all? Or should we be trying to overthrow the Syrian government? And that's a fundamental reexamination that I hope takes place during this presidential election.
Unfortunately, it's not happening right now. pretty much every single candidate, without exception, echoes each other. Even Rand Paul, who, being the son of Ron Paul, you would expect him to have a more sensible foreign policy, but he is such an enigma where I can't figure out what kind of game of patty cake he's playing with the establishment, because he seems like he's still trying to kiss up to certain lobbyists in order to get that payout and donation.
Yes. But
you look at his donations and it's not coming from lobbyists. It's not coming from the upper echelon. So why on earth would he be pandering to these people?
It seems like he's decided that he can get the nomination if he appears to be more middle of the road.
But you're not going to stand out by being the most moderate.
But I think that was a calculation he made. But I think his father, although his libertarian politics and domestic affairs may not have been in tune with most Americans, I think that his forthrightness in foreign policy did.
Well, he definitely wasn't in line with the kind of people who vote in Republican primaries.
Yes. He appealed to a lot of people, but sure. He was, as we've seen so often, candidates who were independent, whether they're Ron Paul or Ralph Nader or Dennis Kucinich or Ross Perot, tend to be marginalized. Now, mm-hmm. You mentioned the importance of donations, and there was a very good article recently in the New York Times about how rich families finance our candidates. In fact, the Times reported that more than a half of presidential campaign money comes from just 130 wealthy families and their associated businesses. And this is largely courtesy of the Citizens United case and the use of political action committees. And in fact, many of the contributions are anonymous because they're made through organizations which are exempt from disclosure requirements. And this is a phenomenon that affects both Republicans and Democrats. As an example, Jeb Bush has raised $103 million from a small group of super givers. 26 gave more than $1 million each.
Which is incredible, given the fact that the guy is so uninspiring.
That's a big check. And Hillary Clinton has a much smaller super PAC, but she reported that most of her $15 million came from just 9 donors, or I should say much of it, giving $1 million each. So it's big money, and as they say, these people giving the money aren't Boy Scouts. So
right.
I think it makes it very hard to have an intelligent debate when it's being done in a framework where the candidates are being financed by just a handful of wealthy families.
It also seems to mean that it doesn't really matter what they say because it has nothing to do with the truth. They're going to go out there and rehearse and say the lines that they rehearsed beforehand with the little index card that was handed to them by the super PAC founders and donors.
Right.
And they go around the country to these dinners meeting the people who give the marching orders. They don't go up on stage and say the first thing that comes to mind. They don't say what's in their heart. They just say what people want them to say. For example, Donald Trump, who I dislike greatly, I do appreciate the fact that he does wing it. He says what comes to mind. I appreciate that. I just think he's wrong-headed in most of the things that he says. However, he said one thing that had a little inkling of truth in it, and he was asked about giving money to different candidates of different sides. And he said in one of the things, he gave money to Hillary Clinton as well as Nancy Pelosi. And his answer to that was, well, when you give money to candidates, you do it because they owe you favors. And then the questioner asked him, well, what did Hillary Clinton or Nancy Pelosi give you in exchange for your donation? And he dodged it, but they did let him get away with it by saying, well, when I got married, I called Hillary and I told her to be at my wedding and she was there. Okay, you gave money to Hillary Clinton and you just made her come to your wedding? Come on, man, that's stupid.
Marshawn, what do you think?
Looking at the candidates as a whole, oddly enough, as Gus mentioned, they all echo each other's policies. But one of the things that jumped out at me, I read a Newsweek article where Donald Trump was talking about Putin. And he said, Putin is somebody I could do business with. He said, we shouldn't be hostile towards Russia because Putin is somebody we can do business with. And it's kind of scary when Donald Trump was the only voice of reason. Because I'm not a Donald Trump fan by any stretch of the imagination. But he said the one thing that no other candidate was saying, which was, you know, maybe we shouldn't be going at loggerheads with the Russians because unlike ISIS, we might actually be able to cut a deal with the Russians.
Marshawn, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, but thank you for that very interesting observation. And Gus, thank you for your contributions to the show.
Sure.
That's it for this edition of the In Context War Report. The In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc. and is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. This program will be archived at WPKN.org, at RadioForAll.org, and on our show's website, IncontextReport.com. And you can sign up for podcasts of the series via iTunes and Radio For All. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. On behalf of In Context Military Affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe and producer Gus Cataveiro, this is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Thanks for listening. See you next time.